Welcome to the Senate Education and General Government Committee. We've got two public hearings today. We are going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 2599, A Engrossed. Dana?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2599A requires districts to include in their policies specified elements prohibiting harassment, intimidation, or bullying, and prohibiting cyberbullying. It requires districts to make the policies annually available to parents, guardians, school employees, and students. It declares that school districts will be non-standard if they don't comply with these requirements. It declares an emergency. It would take effect July 1st, 2009. We do have a no revenue impact statement and a minimal fiscal impact statement on the measure.
Okay. Bullying is a very complex subject, as I'm sure we'll hear. We have a number of people signed up to testify. Usual rules apply. If you have written testimony, just please forward it to the committee and don't feel the need to read it word for word. I'm not going to limit people to 2 minutes or 3 minutes, but brevity is the order of the day so that we can process and hear everyone's story. So let's start with Dana Hepper, Rachel Cushman, and Joyce Lee-Jones. Welcome.
Thanks, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Dana Hepper. I'm the Advocacy Director with Stand for Children, and we're here in support of House Bill 2599A. And I'm speaking on behalf of Stand for Children, but I'm also speaking on behalf of the Safe Schools for All Youth Coalition, which is made up of a number of organizations, including youth organizations, disability, minority and girls advocacy organizations, such as the Oregon Education Association, Latino Network, Disability Rights, et cetera. They're in my testimony. And we want to make the point that bullying and harassment is just far too common in our public schools today. The latest information from the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey indicates that 31% of 11th graders and 41% of 8th graders have experienced bullying and harassment in the past 30 days. Minority students report bullying at higher rates, upwards of 50% among African American students. And rural students, in particular, are 26% more likely to experience bullying than urban students. Students with developmental, psychological, and physical disabilities are at a substantially higher risk as well. As you can imagine, anyone with any kind of difference is targeted all too often in our schools. You're going to hear a lot of stories specifically today. But one of the reasons Stand for Children became interested in this issue was because 10% of the students who drop out of high school report dropping out because of bullying and harassment. So if we want to ensure more kids finish high school, graduate on time, and have an improved chance to succeed in life, this is an issue that has to be addressed. The bullying not only impacts students while they're in school, students who are victims of bullying are more likely to experience depression, substance abuse, anxiety, behavior problems, attempted suicide, and these consequences continue into adulthood. And it's not just those who are bullied, it's actually the bullies themselves as well. Unchecked bullying leads to greater criminal behavior among adults. And we know that effective anti-bullying policies can help cut bullying in half. So that's why we're supporting House Bill 2599A. It puts Oregon on this path by strengthening our existing statute. I'm submitting testimony along with my own from two Stand for Children members, Paige Stoudemire and Alex Pickett. Alex is a counselor, and she writes, "Did you know your son sits in class deciding the safest path to his next class instead of focusing on instruction? And that he often doesn't eat lunch because a bully takes it and dumps it in the trash. His learning is compromised daily." Paige Stoudemire writes that her daughter has been a victim of bullying within the school by another second grader for over a year. "The bully has bitten my daughter, pulled chunks out of her hair, and slapped my daughter so hard on the face it left a mark for several hours. The impact of this bullying and harassment has been a struggle for Paige as a mother. She writes, "My daughter is afraid to go to school for fear that this bully may act on her threats of hurting her or killing her. I struggle with her to get her ready for school, or she tells me that she's sick and cannot go to school. She does not feel safe or secure at her school. She has no motivation, nor is she inspired to be at this school. Her work has suffered due to the bullying. We think Oregon's existing bullying statute doesn't go far enough to help parents and families address productive ways to resolve bullying. In ORS 333-351, bullying is defined, and it's defined pretty much exclusively on the basis of physical harm, but we all know that bullies don't have to come to blows to cause a serious blow to students. So House Bill 2599A further clarifies hostile educational environment to include psychological well-being in the definition, and this is a well-established legal standard. The proposal also adds class status to the definition of bullying to make it really clear that students who experience harassment because of their race, gender, religion, et cetera, it's still just that, harassment. And House Bill 2599A makes clear that the new standard, like the old one, covers all bullying activity and is not just limited to class status. Finally, the existing statute states that school districts must have a policy on bullying and harassment, but what House Bill 2599A does is it lays out minimum standards for what that policy must include. And so the policies must, under this bill, cover behavior at school-sponsored activities or on school-provided transportation, identify a point person at each school to whom students, parents, and teachers can report incidences of harassment, ensure a uniform complaint process across the district. The policy must be available to the public and posted. And the policy must encourage further training for teachers so that they're ready to help prevent and address bullying. Again, thanks for the time to testify. I'll turn it over to the other folks on this panel and then be available to answer any questions.
Thank you. Go ahead and start out with your name.
Yeah. Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Rachel Cushman. I'm here today to testify in support of the improving the anti-bullying laws in Oregon. I'm a student at the University of Oregon. I'm 22 years old, and I'm a Chinook Native woman. I'd like to tell you two stories today. One is my own, and one is my brother's. We grew up going to public schools in Oregon. Beginning in elementary school, we experienced constant bullying and harassment based on identity and beliefs we were raised with as Chinook Natives. It started with name-calling. Kids would call us savage. We were both told that we were stupid and that our people had been conquered. I was even called a heathen. This time was very difficult for me, and it affected my educational experience. It was even harder for my brother. He has severe dyslexia and a disability. He was harassed as a kid and picked on constantly. This often escalated to physical harassment. While he was suffering, the teachers would say, "That's just how kids are." He experienced ongoing bullying and intimidation. As a result, he moved schools a number of times, even more than I did. This constant barrage of harassment took its toll. Quickly, my grades began to decline. The way I was treated by my classmates left me disengaged. It was even worse for my brother. The bullying, intimidation, and harassment made it impossible for him to succeed at school. He always wanted to go home early. Many mornings, my brother would hold my mom. He didn't feel like going at all. When he went to school, he often would only make it through a couple of hours before calling my mom and saying he needed to come home. In middle school, I was lucky enough to meet a Native American recruiter from the University of Oregon. She gave me support and hope that I could represent my community and be successful in school, despite my experiences thus far. I was moved by this unprecedented support and became determined to do well and go to college. I graduated and enrolled at the University of Oregon in 2005. It was difficult, but I'm one of the few success stories. Unfortunately, my brother is not. It became a downward spiral for my brother. He'd get harassed, then he would react or defend himself or seek refuge. After one incident on the playground, he climbed on the top of the school roof to hide. This happened continually. He found himself being bullied and responding to the bullying, which in turn got him in trouble. Eventually, this culture of harassment extended itself beyond the school walls, where he was physically assaulted off school grounds by students who attended elementary school with him. He was hurt severely. This was a defining moment for my brother. He no longer had a lot of friends. He became very reserved. It became very difficult for him to trust people. My brother graduated high school but did not continue on to college. His experiences of being bullied and harassed have had serious long-term effects on his life. This all could have been prevented if someone in the school had strong anti-bullying policy. If there had been a point person at the school assigned to deal with these issues, things might have turned out differently. It's especially important to list out protected classes so that it's clear that harassment, based on the fact that we are Native people, and because my brother had a disability, is unacceptable. Please support HB 2599 to strengthen school policies addressing bullying. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, my name is Joyce Liljeholm. I'm a school counselor, retired after 32 years service in public schools. I've been an adjunct professor at Lewis and Clark College. I am an active volunteer with Coalition Against Hate Crimes, the Healthy Kids Learn Better Coalition, and PFLAG, Parents, Family, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. I am the parish visitor in my faith community, and I am a wife and mother. All these roles have led me to co-found Oregon Safe Schools and Communities Coalition, working for a safe, supportive school environment for each and every student. We are pleased to be working with the Safe Schools for All Youth Coalition this session to support House Bill 2599. Bullying, harassment, and intimidation can be a very serious problem. During my career, I sometimes worked in schools with clear, well-enforced policies, and sometimes in schools with minimal, poorly enforced policies. In those latter situations, my students suffered terribly before any relief was provided. A young man, perceived to be gay, was receiving death threats. A young Asian woman was so distraught from the harassment she was enduring that she talked to me about wanting plastic surgery to change the shape of her eyes. As unfortunate as these situations were, I was concerned about the bullies as well. One very bright young man was needlessly expelled from school because his escalating behaviors were not effectively addressed early on. Let me share a positive experience. In a school with a clear policy, there were posters in every room spelling out behavior expectations. In the spring, when a student acted in a very offensive way, students came to me right after class seeking a copy of the poster to replace one that had earlier been defaced and discarded. Minutes later, the teacher of that class came seeking coaching on how to address the offender's behavior and restore safety to his classroom. The policy had worked. Strengthening Oregon's anti-bullying policies will help lead to early intervention, which is the key to success for both those that bully and those who are bullied. Upon retirement, I began volunteering with Oregon Safe Schools and Communities Coalition. I met fair-minded school staff from across the state, deeply troubled by needy students, limited resources, struggling parents, and overwhelmed staff. We provided programs for establishing a safe school environment for sexual minority youth, which in turn helped make schools safer for all students. Wonderful things have been happening around the state. You will hear some courageous youth tell their stories. I'm here to affirm them and speak for others who still cannot safely talk with you. So many people are saying enough to harassment. Too many youth have suffered permanent harm from verbal and physical attacks. Too many students have become depressed and some even suicidal. We want all of Oregon's youth to be safe. On a personal note, my sons never told me they were bullied. In elementary school, it was a parent volunteer called me to alert me to what she had observed. I knew there were policies in place, but my son did not. I taught him how to access help from his school. At middle school, a school bus driver who attends my church reported that my other son was suffering daily abusive verbal harassment. Relief was available, but he had no idea how to access it. House Bill 2599 insists on clear publicity of the anti-bullying policies to students as well as the entire school community. Fortunately, my sons continued on to academic success. As many youth will tell you, they have not been as fortunate. Oregon needs House Bill 2599 to ensure both physical and emotional safety of our youth. Then they will be free to pursue their education and contribute to our community. Thank you for hearing my testimony. I urge you to pass House Bill 259.
Thank you. Committee, questions? You did a great job. Gina Frazzini, Jory Card, and Leonie Reeves.
Good afternoon. Chair Haas and members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify before you today on this important issue. My name is Gina Frazzini. I'm the Executive Director of Basic Rights Oregon. We're the statewide advocacy organization for the gay, transgender, and allied community, and we represent tens of thousands of Oregonians across this state. 2 years ago, thanks to the leadership of the Oregon Legislature, our state became a fairer and more equal place with the passage of the Oregon Family Fairness Act and the Oregon Equality Act. These laws demonstrate that we're slowly but surely finding our way to a more compassionate and equitable future, and House Bill 2599A represents a critical next step. In my travels around the state, I've heard from parents, from school teachers, faculty, and youth about the problem of bullying, harassment, and intimidation in our schools. And I've sat with children as young as 9 years old who've shared their pain and humiliation and the experiences that they've suffered through in the hopes that we could see change. And I've seen the statistics. You all have quite a few statistics in front of you today. For instance, the National Crime Prevention Council reports that 6 out of 10 American teens witness bullying at least once a day. So it's affecting all of our youth, and we know that bullies go after kids that are different. The climate's particularly grim for kids who are perceived to be or are gay or transgender, and for children of gay or transgender parents who are often singled out as well. Even when the name-calling isn't directed at them personally, gay youth are surrounded by expressions every day in school like "that's so gay" or "you're so gay," meaning stupid or worthless, and derogatory remarks like "faggot" and "dyke." And moreover, for every gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender student who reported being harassed, 4 straight-identified students said they were harassed for being perceived as gay or lesbian. This type of repeated harassment is all too common. National climate surveys in the schools indicate that nearly 90% of students report hearing these remarks frequently or often. In some ways, it's become such an everyday occurrence that it barely even merits notice in the schools. These same surveys found that students from schools with a safe school policy that includes protections based on sexual orientation and gender identity heard fewer homophobic remarks, experienced lower levels of victimization related to their sexual orientation, were more likely to report that staff intervened when hearing homophobic remarks, and were more likely to report incidents of harassment and assault to the staff. Certainly, HB 2599A will help address a serious problem. The bill improves and clarifies existing law to ensure that every school in every district in this state can create a safe environment for all students, and that our teachers and faculty have more tools in the toolbox, that they have clear expectations to hold students accountable. With clearly communicated standards combined with set procedures for dealing with problems as they arise, and a designated point person for each school community ensures that we have early intervention, and we know that that's critical. HB 2599A expands the definition of bullying to include psychological well-being. It's a well-established legal concept used in employment law that recognizes the psychological harm of harassment. This ensures that harassment does not have to get physical for someone to intervene. And as you've heard, the proposal also adds class status to the bullying definition. It makes it clear that harassment based on a student's actual or perceived race or ethnicity, gender, religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, or ability is indeed harassment. Basic Rights Oregon is proud to be part of the Coalition for Safe Schools. The breadth of this coalition certainly represents how widespread the concern about bullying in our schools has become. So again, I want to thank you for your time and encourage you to support House Bill 2599A.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Leonie Reeves, Chair Haas, members of the committee. I come to you today as an Oregonian, as a product of Oregon public schools, as an attorney, and as a person of color. I moved to Oregon in 1988 from New York. I didn't go to Portland. I went to Coos Bay, which was a huge culture shock for me. I started a high school in the late 80s in the Coos Bay, North Bend area. As I'm sure you all know, the fishing and timber industry were in great decline, and it was a economic and it was a community that was struggling to keep their past. I was part of the future, and I came. I was one of the only students of color in my school, and I was immediately targeted by my classmates. There's a group of about 12 to 13 girls. There was a dozen of them and one of me, and they would wait for me wherever I went, by the bus stop, outside my bathroom, outside the classroom, and try to get in a fight with me. And they would fight with me. And it wasn't a physical, I mean, we would have a physical altercation, but their goal was, through progressive discipline, to get me expelled. Because there was one of me, I would get in a fight, I'd get suspended, I'd come back, there'd be another one lined up to take their place, we'd get in a fight, I'd get suspended for a longer period of time. I ended up in the principal's office over and over again, explaining to them this was a plan to get me expelled, and the principal did not take me seriously, and they said, no, it's just girls being girls, it's all going to blow over, you're going to be fine, you won't be back here again. Well, that obviously wasn't the case. I was back over and over again. I have multiple suspensions. Fortunately, I have gone on, and I am a success story, but the physical issue is not the main issue of why I'm here today. Obviously, I learned how to defend myself physically. It was the emotional and the psychological abuse that I carried with me throughout my entire life. This was 20 years ago, and just recently I have still been struggling with dealing with the trauma that these girls have inflicted me in the past. And it wasn't because, I'll be frank, I was smarter than them. I was going to go further than them. I had a better socioeconomic situation than them. I had a strong family. But the one thing that they had over me was that I was a person of color, and they weren't. And they held that against me every day and made me hate the color of my skin. And so as I moved into adulthood and I moved away from North Bend, Coos Bay, I thought I had left it behind. But when I reached adulthood in my late 20s, I realized that I had hated the color of my skin my entire life, because this is what these girls had taught me, was that it was something that was bad, and it was something that no matter what my success in other areas I could gain, I could not change the color of my skin. I'm here today in a better place, but I had every opportunity and advantage that anyone could have. I had good health care, I had good family, I had good social support, and through a lot of treatment for depression, for an eating disorder, for all sorts of psychological issues, I'm here today as a very healthy, happy, and productive member of our community. But I think, as you'll learn, the people that a lot of the people that aren't in the room today are the ones that didn't have that support and don't have the same success. And so I would ask you to not only consider my story and the story of the ones that you hear today, but the stories that you're not going to hear, because they have not succeeded and they have not gotten a fair education. This bill is very important because it adds the psychological and mental bullying that I think has much longer-lasting and profound effects on students than some of the physical aspects of bullying. So I would encourage this committee and the Senate to approve House Bill 2599. Thank you.
Thank you. I admire your strength of character to get through that. Can I ask where you went to college and law school?
Willamette for both. I'm a proud Bearcat.
you reside here?
I reside in Southeast Portland, and I work for the Attorney General.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Jory Card. I am here today to testify in support of House Bill 2599 and ask you improve anti-bullying laws in Oregon. I am a student at the University of Oregon working towards a degree in Family and Human Services. I support this legislation because I was bullied throughout high school. My story, sadly, is not unique. I grew up in Oregon and attended San Barlow High School in the Gresham area. Throughout my time there, I was bullied because of my perceived sexual orientation. To say that I was bullied feels like an understatement. I routinely walked down the halls of my high school being bombarded by name-calling from my fellow students. They would call me faggot again and again as I walked to class. At lunch, fellow students would throw food at me in the cafeteria. One day I came to school and my locker was covered in hateful language and more of the names and slurs that I had to listen to day in and day out as I walked between classes. But PE was the worst. This is where I was regularly harassed by students in the boys' locker room. The slurs and name-calling would continue only in a more confined space. To make things worse, there was little to no supervision. Here, I feared not only for my emotional safety, but for my physical safety as well, as students would continue the bullying physically, including inappropriately exposing themselves to me. All of this got to the point where I begged my parents to get me excused from a week of PE classes when we had to go swimming. I was terrified of having to be with the same bullies in a more open locker room where I felt much more vulnerable. I was successful in asking my parents to excuse me from PE during the week, but I hardly feel that was really a success, though. I had to go through school skipping and missing out because of how bad the bullying got. To feel safe, I had to drop out of other school activities as well. I refused to join the business and marketing club because so many of the students who bullied me were members. I chose not to subject myself to more harassment in those spaces. And there were no obvious resources for me at my school. There was no one I knew I could go to. I don't remember a single sign indicating that bullying and harassment were unacceptable behaviors in my school. I don't recall a single assembly where the issue was addressed so that bullies could be put on notice. So many people like me could have been helped if there were clear avenues to deal with this. So many people like me could have benefited from open and honest discussions about anti-bullying, anti-harassment policies. So many people like me could have benefited if it was made clear that it's not okay to bully or harass a student because of their sexual orientation or ethnicity or religion for that matter. I hope that you will help make Oregon a place where students do not have to endure harassment as I did in our schools. Please support House Bill 2599 and make sure schools are safe for all Oregon kids. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Just a quick one.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jory, thank you all of you for your testimony. Did you have a counselor you could talk to at high school, or are the counselors too overworked with hundreds of students?
Yeah. We had our curriculum counselors that would help us plan, and then I had another social counselor. But at the time, I was not comfortable even uttering the words out of my mouth. So I don't think I would have been able to walk myself to, you know, to go talk to a counselor about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Lori Satinspiel, Joe Worley, and Bruce Stiller.
In the essence of time, I'll get started. Chair Haas, members of the committee, Lori Satinspiel, the Oregon School Boards Association. With me today is Joe Worley, our Associate Executive Director in our Policy Department, and Bruce Stiller from Eugene 4J. This issue of bullying and harassment is important to districts. A safe environment is key for student learning and achievement, and we all know that. When this bill was heard on the House side, we submitted policies and written testimony, but I thought the issue important enough to have our the districts address sort of what's going on. You mentioned the complexity of the issue, and I believe that's why we needed to be here to speak to that issue today. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Joe to talk about the model policies, and then on to Bruce to talk about the district's perspective on the issue.
Thanks, Lori. Again, my name is Joe Worley. I'm the Associate Executive Director in the Area of Board Development and Policy Services at Oregon School Boards Association. My background of over 20 years of classroom and administrative experience, as well as the last 5 years of working with school districts and school boards, I believe has provided me with kind of a unique perspective of what's happened historically with our schools. I agree and can't dispute any of the numbers that have been presented here today, nor any of the situations that were described to you. Hazing, harassment, intimidation, and bullying in any form is a serious matter faced by all members of our school communities. In the previous testimony, you've heard of some unique situations, and what I'd like to kind of do is separate some of the situations and then talk about what is already in place in our school districts in Oregon. In my perspective, many of the tools that schools need to deal with this situation are already in place, and you have an example of that in the policy that I've shared with you. This policy has been made available to all districts across the state of Oregon. Districts have adopted these policies and their language and have communicated it. It is available to communities through the board policy document. They prohibit behaviors related to harassment, intimidation, and bullying in all forms. I believe this is an avenue for districts to make decisions and deal with these issues as they occur in their districts, but still allow them to the flexibility to utilize the resources that they have that are individual to specific communities. I believe these policies provide that framework of support, and that these issues are very complex, and it's difficult to legislate specific language to deal with them in our individual communities. Upon examination, I think that you can see with these policies that they do, in fact, address the psychological well-being of our students, protected class status as defined by law, uniform procedures, consistent reporting, availability and access to appeal for not only students but their families, and that these issues are the primary concerns that are addressed in the amendments that are before you for consideration. OSBA and other educational agencies have in the past and continue to provide support to districts related to training, policy adoption, and implementation, as well as working with many districts on adopting special programs, for one example, Second Steps program to address bullying issues in schools. The piece that I'd like to separate out is that I think the tools are in place. I think the piece that's needed is continued education for school personnel, for students and communities in dealing with these drastic situations that are faced in our communities. This systemic issue will always exist in our communities. The only way that we can address it is by having agreed commitments on the fact that there's zero tolerance for this type of behavior and that it has to be addressed. I believe that I support fully the notion of continued education related to tolerance and acceptance of others, and would suggest that the current laws are adequate with respect to providing schools with support and direction in dealing with these issues, with the exception of the educational piece, which I do think is something that we need to continue to focus on. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Hass, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Stiller. I'm a school psychologist, and I coordinate positive behavior support in School District 4J in Eugene. Our school district has had a policy, anti-bullying, anti-harassment policy, for about 10 years now, and it very much mirrors House Bill 2599. What I will say is that we have been attempting strongly to go beyond what is required in the bill. We have about 150 to 300 confirmed and investigated reports of bullying or harassment each year. Those are the most severe incidents. They're the tip of the iceberg. The vast majority of incidents of social aggression, gossip, rumor spreading, exclusion, persistent, mean-spirited teasing are covert behaviors that do not come to the attention of adults unless there is proactive intervention in place. So some of the features of effective programs, and I'll give a couple of examples. At the high school level, Springfield High has been piloting a program called Use Another Word. We've been working with University of Oregon on a program called Bully Prevention and Positive Behavior Support. The basic idea behind these programs is to remove the social reinforcers that actually maintain bullying behavior. And we believe in the research, the evidence is that bullying behavior is primarily socially reinforced. Bystander behavior is critical. So the idea is to basically create common language, give kids tools that they can use to put a stop to it, and to keep the conversation going. Because the behavior is primarily covert, student buy-in is critical, and in the more successful programs at the middle and high school levels, having it be largely student-driven is a critical feature of successful intervention programs. So, to summarize, I'm very much in favor of this bill. We already have something very much like this in place. And in my school district, we really want to move beyond this and help develop programs that are going to actually reduce the rates of social aggression.
Thank you. I very much love this phrase you have here, effective programs teach bystanders how to react. And that feels like a big, big part of this. As you noted, student buy-in is critical. But that feels like that's much easier said than done.
It is easier said than done. And when we've been successful, what we've done is developed something like a student advisory committee, and they've taken responsibility for helping to design the lesson plans and deliver the lesson plans. And it's critical that when you create a committee like that, that you get the right students on it. You look at your subgroups, who do we have, and you want those kids represented, the student leaders, and not just the formal ones, but the informal ones. So it isn't exactly easy. If it were easy, yeah. Our student survey data would not indicate that somewhere between 30% and 60% of middle school students will say they have been bullied in the last 2 months, depending on how you ask the question. And that's in schools that have a policy, that have programs, and are actually exerting some proactive effort to reduce this type of behavior.
Thank you. Thank you for your efforts independent of this legislation to keep promoting that. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask the OSBA, thank you for bringing the sample policy, and I wonder if you happen to know which districts have implemented policies. I have no doubt that there are districts like Eugene and 4J where they have very strong policies. I imagine that there's also a lot of disparity even within among schools within a particular district. So did you survey the districts to find out who has policies and who doesn't?
We do have a database that we keep that shows the number of districts that have adopted. It's not complete, but we show that over 70% have policies that address issues related to harassment, intimidation, bullying, cyberbullying. I mean, really, it covers any form. What we don't have is information like what Bruce has shared with the detail of how that's carried out in the districts. And I think that's the piece that we're concerned about, is that the education happens for the personnel so that they know how to use the tools that they already have in place.
Right. And a follow-up, please, Mr. Chair. And you also mentioned something about an amendment. Do you mean the amendment to the existing statute that's in 2599, or is there some amendment that we don't know about that you referred
no,
to?
No, I think I was referring to the language that you have proposed, the
in
bolded
the bill.
Language.
Okay.
Yes,
thank
absolutely.
You. I just want to make sure that's clear for the record. Thank you. Thank you.
Other questions? Mr. Morris.
Thank you for your testimony and previous testimony as well. I think we would move heaven and earth to stop this. But with the work that's underway, the policies in place, will this bill make a difference? And how would it make a difference? I very easily support it, but will it make a difference? How do we actually change the environment?
I believe that it will make a difference. Just getting people talking about it, for starters, is important, and especially when educators look at data and see that over almost half of their students are concerned about social aggression, then they are moved to do something about it. And I'm seeing a tremendous amount of interest, especially in middle school personnel, administrators, teachers, in programs that can be effective in reducing rates of bullying. I get teachers every year that call me almost crying. This kid came to me, what can I do? And will follow any suggestion that might be helpful. So I think it can make a difference. But I think probably the more helpful part about this is it brings it to the forefront. People have to address it. They have to start talking about it more.
Senator Bonamici.
I'm set. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And we're going off the list here. If you haven't signed up and you do wish testified, there was a list here, so I'm going to call up Angela Davis, Barry Lee Coyne, and Lori Wimmer.
I'm Angela Davis from NPR.
Okay, why don't you come up next then? Mr. Coyne, you can come up with are you with them? Why don't you come up now? Ms. Wimmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For your record, I'm Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association and its 48,000 members who are here in support of the amended version of House Bill 2599. We believe that it makes sensible upgrades to Oregon's anti-bullying statutes, and not just for protected classes, but for all students in Oregon schools. We've long supported policies of this ilk and did the original bully bill because we believe that this is a student health and safety issue, which is one of the four tenets of our legislative policies of the association. We believe that the educational environment needs to be a safe place for all students. And we also know that persistent psychological abuse of students by their peers can erode their physical and mental health, as you have heard, sometimes with tragic consequences. We also took a look at the educational research. I noted that when Senator Morse was asking whether or not this would really make a difference, it was my original reaction as well. Will a policy really make a difference in terms of student conduct? And what our research found is that, surprisingly, just the presence of a very clear anti-bullying policy with clear procedures and processes for addressing grievances has a chilling effect on objectionable behavior of student-to-student harassment. And I've cited for you in my written testimony several different pieces of research that I consulted with some pretty compelling results. Incidents dropping from 10 to 50% depending on the particular policies just by their introduction. And also I thought interesting that students felt that they had more of a voice and could make more positive contributions to their school environment if they felt safe. So it wasn't simply perceiving or experiencing greater safety, but it went to a level of citizenship and participation in their school community that went well beyond the issue at hand. And we thought that was pretty interesting. And so we were, of course, happy to collaborate with the bill's makers. It looked different when it first came out, and the bill sat on the House side, and we were happy to participate in a work group to make sure that there was a good balance between the policy directives from on high and the local control piece and the way to retrofit policies that make sense for individual communities. And so while there's some clarity about thou shalt do this and have these processes and policies, it wasn't so prescriptive that it would be inappropriately done. And we also felt that it was important that the professional development opportunities, so we'd like to see them available everywhere under the funding challenges that we're all currently facing. We know that can't be mandated, and so that's now optional. Given that more than 40% of eighth graders who were recently surveyed said that they had been harassed at school in the previous 30 days, it's clear that there is a problem here that demands a solution. We think this is a good one, and we hope that you will pass the bill to the Senate floor.
Thank you. Mary Lee.
Senator Hess and committee, Senators Metzger, Morse, Cruz, who used to be Representative Cruz in Roseburg when I lived there way back when, and then escaped to Sutherland for a little while, and Senator Bomenici, which I guess is Italian for good friend?
Good friend.
Okay. Make the bone. My name is Barry Lee Coyne. I've been a clinical social worker and therapist since 1975. In a way, this is full circle for me, because when I was a social work student in 1974, I appeared before the Costigan Commission in New York State, which was then developing one of the first child protective service laws in the entire country. And so now I'm back at the other end as a junior senior citizen talking about child abuse from peer abuse, in a sense, because that's essentially what it is. And I'm calling my talk Spanning the Discrimination Spectrum. I endorse the bill, but I'm also adding a supplement, which I would like you to respectfully consider. Premise: today's kids become tomorrow's adults. What I'm saying is that those who are kids today, the behavior that is formed then leads us into what they manifest as adults. I grew up not too far from where West Side Story, Leonard Bernstein's play about sharks and jets and gang fighting began, and so I deal with that as a reality, that you learn the tricks of the trade when you're young, and if they're inappropriate tricks, Senator Hess, you carry them on into adulthood. So schools train us in social skills. And if harassment and bullying is okay when young, the carryover can pave the way to domestic violence in adulthood. All of you, I assume, belong to families. You've known of families that have had domestic violence. And that domestic violence, I believe, is formulated by giving a license to bullying when you're young in various forms. So if we don't stop it now, we're inviting the next generation to say, well, it's okay, we'll wink our eyes, we'll shrug our shoulders, domestic violence. I want you to begin to see the connection between the two. I've had four dozen bullying cases that have illustrated one of my particular areas, height and weight bias, that's begun in school. And these are all my talking points. In your bill, somehow it's left out the fact that kids are bullied on the basis of atypical height and weight. When I was a kid, the late Arthur Godfrey had a song. I don't like the verses, but I'll repeat them. I don't like her, you can have it, she's too fat for me. I don't know if any of you remember that song. There was another song recently, a rock and roll song, that put down short people. And I believe that our culture, you know, gives license to that, gives validation to that, and we have to stop that at the school level. If any of you have short or stout friends among legislators or otherwise, and you know who they are, please ask them if they were bullied when they were younger. Dimensional bias merits equal status with race, religion, gender, and sexual orientation. And I believe that failure to include this suggests a lesser importance being accorded to those of atypical height and weight. So my final statement is, stand tall for the short and the stout. I thought a little humor relief will be indicated here so that it is livened up a little bit.
I do appreciate that as someone who, when I was a kid, I was husky. Any questions? Senator Metz.
I guess for Lori, just because I was looking on the list, I'm not so sure the right one to ask is just a couple of things. On page 2 of the bill, okay, well, I'll just say what it is. It just says that they're going to, statement, they're supposed to have a policy, and it says at a minimum, a school district shall make the policy annually available to parents, guardians, school employees, and students in a student or employee handbook. So my first question is, do all schools publish a hard, you know, a real copy handbook for employees and students? We're including this in there, so I guess we're making the assumption that every employee and students have a handbook that they, is that your experience or not?
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, yeah, I believe that every district does have a their policies and procedures, and I think that it's also available online nowadays.
But it's in a handbook. There is one. So every student, 2,000 students at Woodrow High School, get this handbook.
That's my understanding.
Okay, all right. So I just want to make sure that, you know, having the policy is one thing, but printing something that we don't necessarily. And just one other question, because this I thought about this. This is actually in the current language, but now that this bill is back up, it talks about cyberbullying that we added when we did this legislation. And then it's defined, it's using electronic communications to harass, intimidate, or bully. And then those are defined, what those are, harassment, intimidation, or bullying. And one of the things that makes this qualifier is that it takes place on or immediately adjacent to school grounds, any school-sponsored activity, school-provided transportation, or any school bus stop. And I'm thinking, that doesn't make sense, because cyberbullying doesn't mean, I mean, it's, to me, it's not cyberbullying under our law. If I just text somebody when I'm not on the school grounds, I text from home and say, you're a jerk, and, or someone else. The way I'm just thinking this might, and I talked to counsel about this, because if I text you in the room, then yes, but if I text you somewhere else and say, you know, you're fat and ugly, short and stout, whatever, unless I text you from there or you receive it from there, it's just a technical thing, Mr. Chair, but I just thought maybe while we have the bill, that might be worth, that's why it's cyberbullying. It's not on the premises.
That's a good point. Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, if I remember correctly from the 2007 session, this was not just a technical issue. This was a very long debate about what place you draw the line, and whether in the home environment versus the school there were some constitutional First Amendment type issues. I'm no expert on that aspect of it, but I would remark only that it may not be just a technical issue, that there's a very significant point of view on both sides of that.
Yeah, well, I do remember that discussion, and that's my only point, Mr. Chair, was I just kind of wonder if we have an ineffective tool in the statute, because it is an important topic. So that's just wanted to bring that one up, and I'm glad we have handbooks.
I appreciate that. That's a good point, Senator Metzger. Something looks like it. I mean, cyberbullying does not usually happen there at school. Senator Bonamici?
I just am confirming that I always get a handbook from the district every year.
Well, you needed one. I feel kind of badly, because she's friends, you know, good friends. And Metzger is butcher in German. Uh-oh. So you got good friends and the butcher on both ends. And maybe that explains all my questions.
Okay.
You know, so.
Senator Cruz?
Maybe the handbook, could we... my main concern with this is potential impact, small schools, things like that. That is there a uniform handbook? Is there a standard handbook? A school with 100 kids... do they create their own? I mean, that's the sort of thing I'm wondering about. So, if we could have...
Okay.
Thank you. We do have recommended additions to a handbook. We have what we call a model student handbook.
Right.
And it does have...
Go ahead and start with your name.
Oh, again, Joe Worley from Oregon School Boards Association. This is not something that's required by districts to adopt. It's just something that we recommend, and it does have within the handbook suggested language around the prohibition of bullying, cyberbullying, all the things that are mentioned in the policy, and then it does link to the policy document and refers to that document itself. So that's something many districts have in place in their student and staff handbooks. But it's not something that is required at this time.
But this would make it required.
Well, my understanding is this requires that it be available,
right?
Which I think there's an issue there around the definition of what available is. If we've made it available through board policy, that's a public document. I think it was shared here that many times it's located online, it's easily accessible, it's maintained within the district, so it is available to the public.
But the bill specifically says in a handbook, which I think, and so I'm wondering if, because Riddle High School could have their policy, and but, you know, if you have a school of 100 kids, do they have a handbook? Because this bill will require them to do that.
And yes, in that case it would, it Mr. sounds Chair. Like.
Senator Bonner.
It does say in a student or employee handbook.
Well, still a handbook, so, I mean, if
so, your point is this is easier for Portland than for Riddle?
Potentially. You know, it gets down to resource issues, and I don't know. It's just a concern.
Mr. Chair, Lori Wimmer again from Oregon Education Association. It may be that there's something in regulation in the Division 22 standards that relates to the document, and I'm sure that somebody from the Department of Education could answer that for you. But in any case, if we're hung up on the word handbook, there may be a way to just make it a more generalized publication or communication that would enable all the families to know what the policies and procedures are. But I do believe that there is something, if not in statute, then in regulation that does require that there be communication of, because this isn't the only thing that schools are required to inform parents and families about. So I know there is some mechanism that maybe handbook's just the wrong word.
Well, yeah, Ms. Chair, I would agree with that. The ability to communicate, but to define the form may be a bit prescriptive. Yes.
That's a fair point.
Yeah.
Further questions? Okay, thank you. Angela, is your crew standing by? Go ahead and start off with your names.
All right, we got Myra Margigal, and we got Adacio Garcia and Josh Montiel.
We were wanting to add.
Why don't you individually start off with your name?
Okay, my name is Adacio Garcia, and we had came in March, but we didn't have enough time to testify, so we wrote letters to the members, and so we came again to talk about the ethnicities and like why should they add it, and so the reasons why is because like ethnicities covers a certain amount of groups of cultures, like with the Jews and how like millions of people died from that, and Hispanics, because like there's so many reasons that they'll think of things to say to people like that, and it hurts people like that.
Hi, my name is Myra.
Myra, what's your last name?
Madrigal. So we wrote a letter. The purpose of our letter was to ask you to take a look at our request, the request being that you please add ethnicity to House Bill 2599 about bullying. I ask this because along with many fellow students, we have experienced racial and ethnic harassment. We have individually read the bill, and we all have seen that in results 1923, nowhere in the text is there the word ethnicity. I saw race, but my argument for the word ethnicity being added is that race and ethnicity are different. Anyone who wanted, so to speak, cheat the system and try to get away with some kind of bullying consequence would argue that ethnicity was not listed in any of those rules. We are Hispanic, and if someone were to make a comment like, with all due respect, you're a spick, that would not be addressed under the HB 2599 about bullying rules. I'm not requesting this because I'm Hispanic. I'm requesting this because people should not be informed that bullying people because of their ethnicity is just as bad as bullying because of race and handicap. That would help people realize that what they are doing and think before they act. The people who do these kinds of behavior should be educated and punished so they won't do the same mistake. Thank you for your time, and my teacher has some input from some students about cyberbullying, and she'd be happy to share that with you. If you guys have any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Okay. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. I noticed that race, color, and national origin is in the bill, but we will check to see if ethnicity is should be added with the legal scholars here.
Okay.
Appreciate you coming and engaging and helping us with this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Davis, thank you. Yes, if you.
We discussed the logistics around having only three chairs. My name is Angela Davis. I'm a social studies teacher at the Media Arts and Communications Academy in McMinnville. What I'd like to do with you is to share with you that there was over 35 students that reviewed this bill in my class and in another class, in addition to a bullying group at our school. And with regard to cyberbullying, since Senator Metzger, you asked the question, I did take a vote in my class after we read the bill, and my students were, originally they were tied in terms of who thought that it should be addressed through the bill and who thought it shouldn't be addressed through the bill. But after they then debated it, they decided by a majority that it should not be the responsibility of school districts to police cyberbullying, because in our handbook, at our school district, students are not supposed to be bringing their electronics to school. When they do bring their electronics to school, they might be in their pockets. They might go to the bathroom or, you know, behind the football stadium and send a bullying text message to another student. And that would be very hard for the school district to address on every occurrence. And that individual student responsibility for cell phone possession alone is a huge issue in the school districts. So in the end, they wanted to take personal responsibility for their use of cell phones.
Well, we thank you for engaging with us on this.
All right.
And not only is it educational, I hope, for you and your students, but it's helpful for us. Any questions for Ms. Davis?
Thank you.
Thank you. And is everyone... okay. Esther Griffin?
Chairman Haas, committee members, thank you for hearing us today in support of HB 2599A. My name is Esther Griffin. I am a constituent of Chair Haas, living in Beaverton with my husband and two sons, and I'm the vice chair of Beaverton's Human Rights Advisory Commission. I'm also on the advisory board of the Oregon chapter of GLSEN. That's the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network. GLSEN envisions a future in which every child learns to respect and accept all people, regardless of sexual orientation or gender identity and expression. While we all agree that teasing and bullying has gone on in and out of school for as long as any of us can remember, the harassment of youth who are or who are perceived to be gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender has taken on new and dangerous proportions. Even 7-year-olds on the school playground understand that verbal attacks on one's possible sexuality or gender identity is the most hurtful thing you can say. They are calling each other gay and fag, possibly without even understanding what they are saying, just knowing that it's as bad as it can be. In the halls and cafeteria in middle school and high school, many bright and creative students are bullied with epithets regarding sexual orientation and gender identity or expression on a daily basis.
That's So Gay is heard at school throughout the day. And most of the time, no teacher or administrator will intervene and take the opportunity to use this as a teachable moment. Our students are being damaged daily by such attacks. They are not finding school to be the safe haven that sometimes their own homes cannot be. They cannot come to school to learn in peace and find their ticket out to a better life through higher education and a career in an accepting place. Studies have shown that 1 in 3 gay students, or even those merely perceived to be, have skipped school at least once in the last month because they felt unsafe there. 97% of upper grade students hear language such as "That's So Gay" regularly. 3/4 of GLBT students have been harassed frequently based on actual or perceived orientation. The rate of suicide among GLBT youth has been estimated at anywhere from 3 to 5 times higher than that of the rest of the population. Many times, we don't even know the accurate figure, as our youth will take their life before ever telling an adult what is going on. There is still such a social stigma about being gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender that our students cannot always reach out for the assistance they need to attend school without being harassed daily. I work directly with students in the Gay Straight Alliance at Southridge High School in Beaverton. This is a wonderful group of intelligent, compassionate teenagers who face discrimination the likes of which we have no possible idea. It erodes their self-esteem and confidence. It chips away at their academic performance and future success. And yes, it does permanent damage that may hold them back from reaching their full potential. When many of us came to Salem in March to speak with our senators and representatives about passing the Safe Schools Act, it turned out that every one of us in my group, including myself, had been a bullied child, and we still carry that pain with us many decades later. We all felt that it had taken something very valuable from our lives. We came to ask that it not go on like this for another generation. It breaks my heart to think that if we don't intervene now, the students I work with today will sit before you or others years down the road, hurt by the words they hear every day at school, asking you to please take some action on behalf of their own children and others. This can't go on. Our youth are being hurt, and it's unfortunate that we need to pass a law to protect them, but if that's what it comes down to, then we must do it. Please make school a safer and more welcoming place for all our youth. Please pass HB 2599A, the Oregon Safe Schools Act. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Can I add something? It was my understanding when I first heard about the bill being proposed that the policy would be posted or readily accessible in any school office. And I think that that may help with the handbook issue as well, if it's ready available to be seen at school at any time. Thank you.
Appreciate what you do at Southridge, too. Okay, has everyone had their day in court on this bill?
Mr. Chair, just a reflection, if I may. What we're really talking about here is how do you change the hearts of people? And by doing it administratively and mechanically and putting it in handbooks and posting it in the office, and that doesn't get it. I just don't think that will make a difference. But if you have something that addresses how do you change an environment? How do you change a culture? You know, clearly that bullying, it's not restricted to a protected class. It's pervasive with children. And children can be the most vicious and mean-spirited. It's just kind of a thing. So I think this bill is something to think about. How do we focus on changing the hearts? And I'm not just sure what that is, but I think it would be worth thinking about.
Appreciate that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
I agree with Senator Morse that it's important to work on changing the hearts of people who are engaged in this, but I also heard testimony that in schools where they do have readily available policies like this, the bullying does go down. So maybe it's not a perfect solution, but I think it's a very important step.
Okay. I will close the hearing on House Bill 2599A. We will take a 2-minute recess here and adjust seats and come back for a hearing on 2822.
Do you have some
more
sit there?
Whatever.
Bill 2822, and Representative Greenlick and Senator Rosenbaum, would you like to testify?
And I'll just briefly, if you like, Mr. Vice Chair, indicate that House Bill 2822 establishes a way of necessity for private sewer lines. It specifies evidence that a petition to establish a way of necessity for a private sewer line must contain, and it terminates the way of necessity 6 months after local government has issued a notice to affected property owners declaring completion of a public sewer line that provides direct access to the land. There is no revenue impact from the measure and no fiscal impact.
Welcome.
Thank you. You want to go ahead?
All right, I'll be very brief because we have two interesting stories here to tell. I first became aware of this when I got a call from a constituent's daughter talking about a situation where...
Excuse me. Who are you?
Who are you?
Do I have a card? I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33. Thank you for reminding me. I remember about 1 out of 3 times.
That's not bad.
I first heard about this situation when I got a call from a constituent's daughter who... you'll hear from in a bit, talking about how it turned out her father was on a party sewer line in the city of Portland, and that the city was beginning to try to do away with party sewer lines. That means maybe two houses in the back of a street coming through the sewer line of one in the front of this, in front of them, and then hooking up to a sewer. So there are two or three people hooked up to a sewer. The city decided that wasn't the right thing to do, and they wanted to try and straighten it out. Well, in order for it to straighten out, the person had to get an easement through the property of the person in front of them to attach to a sewer, or they had to go all the way around and create a $50,000 expense or so to hook up with another sewer. Well, the person in front of them wanted to charge them a lot of money, and you'll hear about it now, to get authorization to go through their property. We contacted the city. We tried to find out what's going on. You'll hear from the city today. They have a solution on how to create a way of necessity. Is that the right word?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I heard about it one more time from my brother, who also was the front property in a situation like that, and he was telling me that the people behind him had to get a right-of-way, and I said, oh, how did you do it? Did you charge him for it? And he said, charge him? Why would I charge somebody to... didn't cause me anything to get them through. I said, well, because you could have held them up, right? And he said, are you kidding me? I mean, it seems so weird. This bill represents, I think, a simple solution to that. It provides protection for the property owner that needs to get to a sewer and the property owner through whom property the right-of-way needs to go. And it passed, I think, almost unanimously out of the committee in the House and out of the House itself, and I...
Actually, it did.
Unanimously.
There were some excused, but, yeah, unanimous.
Some people just vote against things because they're mine.
Which is oftentimes a damn good reason, Mitch. But
so I'm never sure. At any rate, it did, and I thank you for hearing it, and I hope you work it, and I'll leave it to my colleague and yours and... my constituents and the City of Portland folks. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Representative Greenlick. And good afternoon, Mr. Vice Chair and Senators. I am State Senator Diane Rosenbaum from Senate District 21 in Southeast Portland and Milwaukee. And I'm sort of amazed at the range of issues that this committee takes up, having caught the tail end of the hearing before.
General government.
Very general. I just had a few comments and then a personal story about the subject matter of this bill. At first glance, it might not be evident why this issue involving sewer connections needs to come before the legislature at all. But if you've had any experience with how disruptive and costly these situations can be, I think you'll rapidly appreciate why there does need to be a solution, and I think the one presented in this bill is a good one. And my district, Inner Southeast Portland, is really sort of ground zero for these situations. Neighbors sometimes share these common sewer connections and aren't even aware of it. And I can tell you this is true because this is exactly what happened to me. Up until about 2 years ago, the term party sewer was really not something I had ever heard. And believe me, if it happens to you, it's no party. This is not a party that you ever want to attend. So in my case, we had the usual. We have one of these old houses built in 1911 and had water in our basement and thought we had a broken pipe or the washing machine was leaking or something like that. But, you know, we called a plumber and rapidly found out that it was nothing as simple as that. In fact, when they started to trace the lines outside of the house, found that we had an old clay pipe sewer. The pipe had been there since the house was built and had broken, as these old clay pipes do. And that would have been bad enough because, you know, raw sewage was seeping into the ground. But not only that, but we found that we were connected from our house to three of our neighbors before the line got out to the connection in the street. So it was not a simple matter of just fixing it. It was also having to figure out that all these other people were involved. This is not really what you want to do, is go knock on your neighbor's doors and say, excuse me, you may not think that you have any problem, but my
sewer connection is connected to your sewer connection, and now all of us are going to have to pay to get this fixed. So that's not a happy thing. In our case, we actually were able to connect through another neighbor, and who was just one house away from where the sewer connection was in the street. And luckily for us, those neighbors were willing to give us an easement so that we could tunnel under their property, which wasn't inexpensive, but at least we didn't have to go through the hassle of trying to fight out the right-of-way and all of that. So having had that experience, I know that this is a problem that needs a solution. I think you will hear shortly from the city about what the technical aspects of this bill are. But I can tell you, because when this happens, and these properties are so old, it's not easy to even figure out where these lines are going. You have to get maps that the city maintains. And you can imagine if this goes back to 1911, 1912, thereabouts, that the maps that are available are not always accurate. So you're often just sort of guessing. You know, they put a camera down these lines to try to figure out where the cracks and breaks are. So it really is an ordeal. And as I said before, the party part of this is not really much fun. So I'm supportive of this bill. I'm glad you're hearing it today. I would answer questions, but I'm really not the right person to ask them of. If you have technical questions, I hope that you'll save them for the witnesses that are to follow.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have, looks like, three more folks to testify. Dean Marriott, Graham Conroy, and Gilliam Conroy. I'd like to come forward, please.
You know, Mr. Chair, I just kind of wonder if this is kind of a Portland issue. You know, they share sewer lines. And you're noticing in Southeast Portland where they share driveways. They do a lot of sharing, you know, that ends up becoming problems later. I just kind of wonder why they created those things that way.
Glad to tell you about that.
Oh, I go first. Okay. And actually, that's a great segue into why things got created and when they did. So when you look at, you know, back...
Excuse me, your name,
I'm sorry,
please.
My name, Gillian Conroy, and I'm actually a resident of Clark County, but my father, Graham Conroy, is a resident, lifetime resident of Multnomah County, and I lived in the house that has the issue for a couple of decades before moving. So when you look at when these things happened, so back in 1897, my dad's neighborhood was surveyed. His home was built in 1900, so the sewer went in just prior to that. At the time when this all began to start, we found out that there was a 107-year-old sewer that was a party sewer. Again, not a party. When we found out about it, my dad's situation was a little bit different because it wasn't something where a pipe along the party sewer went out. What happened is the neighbor closest to the sewer from my dad had planted a tree on top of the sewer on his own property and broke the property. So imagine the lines coming down from my dad's into the main, but it's broken below that in the branch from the neighbor. The way that the Bureau of Development Services has written the code that came in within the last couple of decades is that regardless of what happens, everybody becomes liable and you have to sever the relationship of the party sewer. And it didn't matter that this was done that way. The way that the code reads is if someone is at fault, everybody has to equally be responsible for this, and then you have to litigate it civilly if there's a challenge. So this is how it started. We found out that from the neighbor's action, he was getting, you know, sewage leaking, contacted the Bureau of Development Services. That neighbor, Chris Wilkerson, and my dad worked together on this for months before my dad was notified. He actually had gotten a note in his mailbox, just contact me within 24 hours or I will be disconnecting your sewer. My dad's paid sewer bills for, well, we've been there 30-something years, you know, paid sewer bills, never knew he was on a party sewer. So a number of different things happened, and then Bureau of Development Services has something written into the code that allows them to do a capping permit. So with the capping permit, the way it's written into the Bureau of Development Services, if you and I are on a party line and I decide that I'm the one closest to the sewer, and I don't want to give you an easement, I can cap your sewer off. Doesn't matter if you have a right-of-way. Doesn't matter if you're landlocked. I have that right within 30 days to cap your sewer. And what that would do to you is it would put you into violation with the City of Portland, with the Bureau of Development Services, and your house could actually be condemned because you would have sewage leaking unless you could have some other solution. So it's a really horrible thing. And if everybody was great and everybody got along and nobody was greedy, that would be a fantastic thing. That's not the case. And my dad will go more into what happened with Chris Wilkerson. But when he looked, so let's say that this is my dad's house and this is Chris's house. Here's 24th. The sewer is on Northrop. So my dad, the only way that he could do it would be to continue on the party sewer, which actually the Bureau of Development Services did agree to. But then Chris didn't want that. He was actually looking for a payday, and he told them that he refused to let my dad be grandfathered onto the sewer. And so that started a chain of events where, you know, I went to Bureau of Development Services on my dad's behalf and worked with some folks there, and basically they said their hands are tied. If Chris doesn't want you to, we have no mechanism in government that allows us to force him to give you an easement. Because back in the late 1800s, it was a handshake. And probably, as we've looked through records, one person owned multiple properties and did the division. So, you know, it's one of those things where you don't have the types of easements that people know to put in today. So if you have one person here who knows, basically Bureau of Development Services had told him that my dad had two choices. Either Chris allows him across the right-of-way or that he would have to build a sewer project because there was no sewer project planned for 24th. His third option was to go through another neighbor clear behind. She was fantastic, offered to let us. It was a $45,000 price tag because we would have to pull up her tenant's sidewalk and an oil tank and some other things. But she was more than willing to let us do it at no cost. Unfortunately, the construction costs were so high. And so when it came to the city issue, the vitreous pipe that was mentioned, so those clay pipes, another neighbor had one of those. And there's a water main in the same street where my dad would have to build it. So now this city project that my dad was going to have to privately fund became exponentially higher. So somewhere between 50 and 100 grand could have been the final price. My dad, we ended up, what are we down, something like $20,000, $30,000 of his retirement went into lawyers and trying to fight the capping permit and trying to keep from having his house condemned. And I mean, the amazing things that came out of this was my dad, I mean, he's a lifetime professor, World War II veteran, did everything right, and he was being told, well, you could sell your house to pay to fix it. I mean, it just, you know, and the thing, and I, you know, some of the issues I know because my dad's going to bring it up, I won't go into all of the detail on, you know, on Chris and everything, but the Bureau of Environmental Services with Representative Greenlick and all of the work that we did with Vicki Gradinsky from Sam Adams' office and Randy Leonard and Ty from his office, we were able to get through all this. And I'll be honest, without, I mean, it became pretty much a full-time job for me. The phone calls, the working with the press, all of these things, finding out that there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 to 4,000 people in some of these older neighborhoods who, you know, as I would say, have a ticking time bomb under, you know, they have no idea they're on a party sewer. And right now, what we're finding is that these stories are coming up, and it will get worse. As these pipes get older, and if people don't have a right-of-way, and you have someone looking for a payday, I mean, Chris wanted tens of thousands of dollars from my dad to grant him, and it wouldn't have even been a right-of-way. It would have been a license, which he was selling his house, so it would have been about a year for tens of thousands. So the reason that we feel this is important, my dad has found a solution, the Bureau of Environmental Services. We were kind of the, I guess you'd say, the test case that this is based on. But when we, you know, when we went through that, I wanted to make sure that no one else has to go through that again. Because if you take this out a little bit further, just think of, you know, the Southeast Portland neighborhood. Okay, you've got somebody who's lived there all of their lives, who maybe doesn't have the assistance of family, who is on a fixed income, who can't get an attorney. What are they going to do if they don't have somewhere to go? They'll probably contact some of the same folks. But if they don't have a solution and you have someone who can cap your sewer, you know, what is that person going to do? I mean, if my, you know, if I hadn't helped my dad in negotiating all of it and navigating, I think it would have been, you know, it would have been a pretty awful outcome. And the Bureau of Environmental Services and everything they came up with, you know, it was a fantastic solution, and it was, you know, a price tag that we could live with. If we could take out the lawyer fees from earlier, that would be even better. But you know, it was the right thing to do, and I'd like to see that for other people who are going to end up in large numbers, probably with the same situation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Conroy?
Yes. Well, of course, I'm Graham Conroy, her father, and happy to be here in front of all of you with the chance to testify for House Bill 2822, which I think is a solution to many of these problems that have arisen. And it was interesting that it was arising on its own while we were still having the problems back in the city. Thank to my daughter for going through all the intricacies of this thing, which I probably wouldn't remember.
I don't really want to.
I'm trying to forget. But anyway, I've been a resident in Northwest Portland now for over 34 years. And as she mentioned, I was a professor at Portland State for, well, a number of years, retiring after my full term there in 1989. And everything was fairly quiet and a very nice neighborhood where people looked after one another, helped out, and so on. And it was just a very, very, very pleasant neighborhood. And I wasn't envisaging any problems coming up, just fun to read your books, play your music, do a few things like that, and teach school. And then suddenly all of this happens when the new neighbor moved in. And the old neighbor moved out and was building a new house over in Mosier. And he left, and the problem started occurring not too long after that. As Jillian said, I was a veteran in World War II, actually, in the Navy, and that's how I was able to get my house through the state GI Bill. And had a fine time living there, but I didn't know about that party in the area, and it certainly wasn't a party, but I found out about it. And then when I was going through my travails, people still ask me if this is ever settled or not. In fact, a couple of friends brought that up the other day who were in Portland State at the same time that I was there. And I said, no, we have come to a partial solution, but there's still other property problems about the whole thing. But the main thing was getting the sewer problem solved, and in a very, I felt, hostile and bad intentioned environment, except for all the other neighbors. But this gentleman had a overwhelming sense of self-entitlement, I guess, and just decided he would push things and see what he could get out of it. And I'm not exaggerating on that. Well, anyway, but as I say, I've lived in my present home since purchasing it in 1976, and my former neighbor, Dr. Potts, who was chief of the emergency physicians, at Kaiser Medical. We got along on quite well, and actually he had a full-length grand piano up on his third floor, and in the summer when the door was open, you could hear Chopin wafting down. It was very pleasant. It was like having my own artist in residence, and not one I had to pay for. Any rate, I've had many advantages and friendships in the neighborhood, and even since my retirement, because I retired in 89, and everything seemed to be going well, as I said, until a few years ago when the friend and longtime neighbor, Ron Potts, moved to Mosier, selling the house to Chris Wilkerson. And during that time that Christopher was there, he became married to a lady friend of his. They moved into the house and had two children since they were there. While he was married, a couple had the two children. I still see both of them, and the wife is living there, but they've run into some marital problems, partly as a result of this whole fiasco over the property questions and the sewer. Anyway, when he was married and when the children were born, I talked to them, congratulated the parents on the birth of their children, but the Wilkersons were quite taciturn and not interested in really making friends in the area. But relations tended to be somewhat cordial, and we did exchange hellos, but that was about it. And this all changed drastically, though, when I received this handwritten note just stuck into my mailbox, not signed, but I recognize the signature, of course, demanding that I detach my sewer line from his. The sewer line had been breached and broken near the juncture with the main city sewer, and in northwest Portland, all the sewer lines run east to west and not north to south, and my front porch faces north to south, so that means there was no line out there. Something had to be built if I were to go the shortest way rather than doing something to try to get an easement from his property, which he wasn't about to give because he wanted lawyer's fees, he wanted money for running a camera down things, or so he claimed. We were always left out of the loop. Nothing was told to us about what was happening. Things would happen in City Hall. We would hear about them after their fait accompli. So never were we consulted on any of the moves that he was making. And through his lawyer, he was demanding money, and money way beyond what the problem of the sewer line was. And I said, well, I'm just minding my own business, sitting back on the end of the sewer here and not doing anything, because the thing had broken right by the entrance to the east-west pipeline over on the far street there. Things escalated then after that first note, and then came a series of other demands, and some of these also had just little notes shoved into my mailbox and saying you have to do this by such and such a time or all this will follow, what Jillian was mentioning about. And he said, the way he said it was things, or I'll say, escalated with these other notes, that I'd disconnect from his sewer, and he put the emphasis on his. I said, well, Chris, I pay sewer taxes. I don't know whether he knew that or not. You know, he thought he was paying for everything. And so it was just very much out of phase there as to what he thought was going on and what was happening. And then other outrageous demands were made for lawyer fees and so on. As a result, I became very depressed at his truculence, dishonesty, and actually mean-spirited behavior. And, of course, there was a great disparity between our ages, so I wasn't used to this sort of behavior. And in the meantime, going to various meetings and seeing other people, I find that there are a series of my friends that lived in North Portland and also in Northeast Portland, some of them artists, some of them poets and so on, who were getting by on rather small jobs and barely subsistence, and they were having the same problems. So they had to go to the meetings of the various boards and try and make a plea for themselves. So as I say, ours was pretty much of a test case. It was the first time they actually dug up the street and put in a new sewer somewhere, at least in the northwest section. And then when people were finding out about this, they'd keep coming around asking me questions and so on, and so I was able to help them somewhat. But unfortunately, they all had to go see Ty, I guess, or call him, or Lena Danaher. So on and on it kept going. And at that same time, I was trying to work on a book with some ideas in philosophy and so on. And so that served many sleepless hours and hard times at night. And during that time, I had a stroke as well. And although there's no causal factor there, as far as one could state, it certainly didn't make my condition any better. So after the solution came up, after all these costs, supposedly, of tens of thousands of dollars, which still ran up, and even with the city's help, but it would have been much, much more without the city's help in coming up with a solution, realizing how bad things were in my situation, and that for all other people in the neighborhood. And so I felt I had to say something and testify too on this bill, hoping and urging you to put it through. I'm glad that the House did so, and I'm looking forward to the Senate's action on this. But I think it's a great thing to be able to have a solution to this, and you won't get into these situations where you have great imbalances of power on one side or the other, or changes in money ability and so forth and so on. So anyway, since one of the people that I was talking to and advising and telling them what had happened and how we'd worked it out with the city and so on, one person who was down on money and so on actually sold his house in the Northwest and moved to a different city entirely. And I think he'd been a photographer who had worked for the Oregonian for a number of years way back. And so some people moved away. Others still tried to cope and find ways of handling this. So anyway, I hope that then that since the city has acted somewhat, and they still have far to go on that with some of the other cases that are up, and that the state can come up with some rules and laws that will obviate these kind of problems and allow a much more fair playing ground for the people, so undue advantage won't be taken of by one side or the other. So thank you for allowing me to be here and to make these comments. And
thank you, Mr. Conroy. I do have one question. What is preliminism?
That was my question.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
Well, whatever it is, it precedes
just very,
itself.
Very briefly.
Yes. It's my friend, the artist Rex Amos, and I invented this about 40 years ago, and it hasn't died. It's still going on. And the idea was that some of the art philosophies that were around, like Surrealism and Dadaism, just didn't go far enough. They became too serious. We felt you had to keep humor in your talk about the world, basically time, space, all these things. And so we came up with this little philosophy that said, what's important is everything precedes itself, even itself. And so you get into all these wonderful kind of things that wouldn't work, contradictions and so on. And
it sounds like the political process.
In fact, well, one did. Bud Clark, when he was mayor of Portland, said to a Russian delegation one day, "We have a philosophy of our own that's called preliminism." I don't think he thoroughly explained it to the Russians, however.
Didn't he give Johnny Carson
preliminism
pencils? Thank you. Oh, yeah, and I gave him some stuff to take, and he went on Johnny Carson's show, and so he gave him a lot of this propaganda that Rex and I had worked up.
Well, thank you.
He didn't know what to do with it.
We'll need to move on here to Mr. Marriott.
Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Morris and members of the committee, I'm Dean Marriott, Environmental Services Director for the City of Portland. And I noticed the title of the bill, Authorizing Ways of Necessity for Temporary Sewer Connections. I was thinking of a more dramatic title, Avoiding a Nightmare on Elm Street, might be a better one. Otherwise, it sounds kind of dry. I think you have a handout here which includes a map of Portland with over 3,000 red dots. Those represent our best estimate of the numbers of property owners that are dealing with this problem or will be dealing with this problem. So the records indicate that they are likely to have party sewers. On the back side is a facsimile of some of the kinds of details we're working with, just to very quickly walk you through this. Example number one on this, if you have this in front of you, shows properties A and B, and you can see on the map that there's no indication whatsoever as to whether they're connected to a sewer or not. And this represents some of the problems that you heard about. Some of the records are 100 years old. They're very incomplete. And so what happens is that party, let's say the person at 5040 Webster, decides to sell their house, and they do a property investigation. The prospective buyer does a property investigation, and they find out that they have a sewer line from property A crossing their line, their lot. They didn't even know about it. It's been there perhaps for 100 years. So one way it's discovered is a pending property sale or inspection. Or there's a failure, as was indicated here. There's raw sewage, there's a plugged line. They come out and do an inspection, and that's how they discover which way the sewer goes. Example two is it does show up on a map, and we do have plenty of these in Portland, where it actually clearly shows that property C is connected to the public sewer by crossing the property next door. And again, there most likely is there are no legal documents, easements, or any way that C can get access to the public sewer other than that's the way it was built. And the way it was usually built is a common developer built both homes, and to save some money, they just took the shortest route. And as was indicated in those days, it was just accepted. So example three is where there is a bit of a sewer extension down a street, maybe to serve 3620 there, but property C wasn't served because there didn't appear to be any need to do it at the time. But now property C, maybe their neighbor is no longer friendly and they demand payment for the ability to cross their property. And C has no way to hook into the sewer in the street without an expensive public works project to extend the sewer up the street, and that's where our friends here talked about the incredibly high price tag if they have to pay for the whole thing. So that's just to give you a little foundation of what we're dealing with. Now, I want to be clear, this is not a Portland problem exclusively, by any means. We are one of the older cities and a big city, and so we have thousands of these. But we've been dealing with folks in Sweet Home, Oregon, Gresham, Prineville, Ontario, Central Point, in the Rogue Valley Sewer Authority. All of these organizations and communities have pointed out that they are dealing with these problems too. And it's what the problem is that a property transaction is about to happen. Somebody picks up the phone and calls City Hall and says, I can't sell my house. I'm transferred to Chicago and I can't sell my house because of this party sewer problem. Can you get out here and dig up the street and get a sewer to my house? And so the city runs around like a fire drill trying to solve these problems one after the other, when it would be more sensible to organize and do neighborhood by neighborhood to try to fix this problem. What we are suggesting with this bill, and I think is why the House was impressed with the simplicity of this, is to utilize an existing provision in law, a way of necessity. There's an existing statute, Chapter 376, the Oregon statute, that provides ways of necessity for people to get access physically across someone's property when it's necessary for that reason. And we would tag on to that existing legislation the ability to provide utility access for access to public sewers. So right now, to avoid this jumping from case to case to case, what this would do is provide the ability for a neighbor to go to their neighbor and say, let's talk about this. Can we work something out? And if the neighbor says, you know, I don't think so, but maybe for $50,000 we could work something out, this tool is available. The person who needs to get access to continue to use this party sewer can go to the county, file this request, and get permission to have a way of necessity declared. It will exist until 6 months after the public sewer is available, in which case it then expires. So it allows the community to move in a organized fashion around the community to provide the extensions to the public sewer system that will be necessary to fix this problem. It does also, however, require that the person using this party sewer across their neighbor's property pay just compensation. So it is not giving somebody a property right without compensation. We're very concerned about that, and the bill provides that the person asking for the waive of necessity has to get an appraised value of the easement and then be willing to pay that value. So it sort of levels the playing field. As you heard, that's what the people affected by this are asking for, is let's level the playing field to prevent what is happening too often, and that is it's bringing out the worst in people instead of fairness and neighborliness. Someone sees an opportunity, as they said, for a payday, and then it all goes downhill from there. So we think this bill is balanced, it's targeted, protects the landowners who currently rely on the status quo. It allows for a methodical, cost-effective solution for the communities. Portland has budgeted about $30 million to go around and try to fix some of these. If we have to continue to operate on a fire drill basis, we estimate it's going to add another $10 million to the fix because we can't do it in a comprehensive and organized fashion. And as I said, it does call for the compensation of the affected landowner. So okay. With that, I'd like to close my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Two questions. First of all, how does the compensation work? I mean, I know we already have this, so who determines what is fair and just? How does that, if you know?
Well, Senator Metzger, the bill provides that the report is submitted to the county, which issues the waive of necessity, and it has to include in it a report with an attached appraisal from a certified appraiser who has some familiarity with determining the value of easements like this.
I was just wondering, though, who is, are you responsible for the appraiser? Does someone get to approve the appraiser, or can I be the appraiser and say it's $50,000? And what's the parameters for that? I mean, and if you don't know, that's fine. I mean, don't tell me. But if you don't guess. But if you happen to know, I'm just wondering how that process is.
Where's the dispute resolution?
Yeah, where's the dispute resolution to make sure that the appraiser, that because you're going to have to pay whatever that is that this is a arm's length appraisal.
Yes, Senator, it's an excellent question. Because it's established statute for ways of necessity now for transportation, we're building on that.
So it exists somewhere. It's just not something that we can see right here.
Yes, sir. It does exist now for transportation ways of necessity. What we're proposing is to tack onto that the sewer angle. The bill does call for the report to go to the county requesting the way of necessity, which would include an appraisal. The way that the affected landowner, if they want to contest it, is provided in the existing statutes for transportation ways of necessity, is they go to court and seek to block it that way.
Okay, and then the only other, maybe it's an observation because I probably don't have the answer to this one either, and our one attorney person is gone, is that it seems odd that could even exist as a problem. I mean, where someone could actually hold something like this gentleman stuff hostage. Because you have rights and necessity that you're trying to tie in here. But I know from my own personal experience there's also another law called adverse possession, and I would think that after all those many years that this is an adverse possession, that it has not been contested, that you would have that right.
Let me just say when we sat in my office talking about this case and the hundreds of other cases. We talked to the lawyers. Adverse possession, as Senator Morse just said, open and notorious. Yeah. The problem is this is not open and notorious.
Yeah.
They only discovered it when they discovered it.
Yeah.
And so that was exactly the same question I asked the lawyers. Why isn't this adverse possession? Why don't they have a easement by prescription? I went through all the things that I learned in school, and they kept saying, no, it's not that, no, it's not that, no, it's not that. But they said, it sounds an awful lot like a way of necessity. Yeah. And if we could get the legislature to agree to expand the driveways sort of way of necessity to include a utility line under the ground, I think we can solve this problem.
And then the only other observation I'd make, Mr. Chair, is for Mr. Conroy, one thing I do know for sure, my dad was a postmaster, is that if he put those notes in your mailbox, as you said, that is a violation of federal law.
And we did bring that in.
And so, you could get your lawyers and hold him hostage, okay?
Bring the U.S. Marshal out.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is there any other testimony? If not, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 20. 5.
House Bill 2822.
House Bill
2822.
Get the right bill here. And we'll bring this bill back.
I'm sure we will.
At the direction of the chair. So
thank you very much.
Thank you.
You want to adjourn us, Mr. Chair?
Adjourn, Frank.
And we adjourn.